Well, it's a great pleasure to be back in Vancouver again. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this conference. Looks like a fun one, has been so far. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the black hole information problem or paradox. Hawking's discovery of black hole radiance in 1974 in a sense opened up a new chapter in gravitational physics and actually began what I think can be seen as a crisis, really, in gravitational physics, which crystallized after he published a subsequent paper on information loss in black hole evaporation. And I'll explain a little bit more why that's a crisis, but basically it does lead to what is known as the black hole information paradox, which to this day we're struggling to resolve. We have been struggling to resolve. Now, many, especially those in the string theory community, believe that this is resolved a certain way through the ideas of black hole complementarity and holography. And there's been some evidence to that effect. For example, counting of black hole states, as outlined by Strominger and Fafa and many others, has indicated that string theory has something to tell us about the internal states of a black hole and thus the information in it. ADS-CFT, and that as a realization of holography, of course, first discovered by Maldacena, and so on. So there certainly is evidence that string theory will resolve this puzzle. But so far, no one has given a sharp argument about where the loophole lies in Hawking's original arguments for information loss. And that's what is really, I think, needed to resolve the paradox. Now, not too long ago, Hawking did make such a proposal, which actually was received with, quite a lot of fanfare in the press. But as of yet, nothing has been published on that, and I think that, it would be nice to better understand exactly what he's saying and whether it relates to what I'm going to say or not. So what I'll do in this talk is summarize an argument about where, in particular, locality seems like it should fail. Black hole evaporation, and the relevance of that to the question of information loss. And the key idea is something we call the locality bound, which we believe should summarize where local field theory fails in gravitational physics. Okay, so let me start out by reviewing Hawking's argument, and I'll try to add some pedagogical comments here since I know there's a large student component of the audience and explain some of the background first. So here's a Penrose diagram for a black hole that forms and then evaporates. So you have your infalling matter, say, and then you form a horizon eventually when it gets to be dense enough. And then the resulting black hole will, Hawking, evaporate, and so you'll have some outgoing quanta up at infinity. It will lose mass and ultimately shrink down to essentially zero size, and it's believed disappear completely. So in the end, you'll be back to good old flat space with the outgoing Hawking radiation having been processed from the infalling matter. So that's the basic picture. And of course, no one really knows what goes on deep inside the black hole at the singularity. But that's something where we really expect string theory ultimately, or hope string theory ultimately will really tell us about. Now, why does this lead to information loss, according to Hawking? Well, the basic picture is the following. Consider a family of space-like slices, 1, 2, 3, say. And on this family of slices, let's just look at 1 and 2, we can take the Hilbert space of a quantum field theory. Say you have a scalar field that has formed the black hole and is propagating in that background. you can decompose that into a direct product of states inside and states outside, and those should be independent, so the argument goes. Now, if you start out with a state on this initial slice, 1, and evolve it to a state on a slice 2, which is up, say, close to the horizon, then we expect this initial state, say, take it to be a pure state, to evolve to a state that is a of this form on slice 2, where you have a sum over, with non-zero coefficients, over products of states, independent states inside and outside the black hole. And then you think about what's going to happen when the black hole completely disappears. And the idea is that the information contained in the states here disappears into the singularity, and what you're left with is just the information contained on the slice out here. So in fact, Hawking argued, the situation should be described by a density matrix where you take this state and you trace over the internal degrees of freedom. And that density matrix has a non-zero entropy, the usual or standard definition of the entropy, trace rho log rho, of order m squared, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of a black hole. So the idea is that the information here in the internal Hilbert space is not recovered, and so you have lost information. The outgoing Hawking radiation has missing information. And a quantification of that is this entropy m squared. Now, let's actually dig into that a little bit more deeply and really understand a bit more why we believe that that's what happens and understand why there's a paradox here, really. So let's say more about the paradox and review it. Okay, so here's another picture of the same process. I've drawn, roughly speaking, space going across, time going up. And so we have some collapsing matter, say. It forms a singularity. Here's the horizon. The horizon eventually shrinks down as Hawking radiation comes out. And ultimately, Hawking suggested you're left with nothing but outgoing Hawking radiation. And there's a missing information, again, of order m squared. So that's the picture. But let's think about things a little bit more deeply. So there's a basic fact about information transfer that comes basically from the uncertainty principle. This is what's related to real attempts to understand information transfer. And basically, the statement is that the uncertainty principle tells you that if you want to lose one bit of information in a time delta t, if you want to convey one bit of information in a time delta t, you must use an energy delta E that's given, bounded by the uncertainty principle in order to do so. So in a real sense, if you want to lose information, you have to pay a price in energy. Now you might say, well, when black holes form and evaporate, no big deal. The black holes are extremely long-lived. The lifetimes are something like m cubed, where m is the initial mass of the black hole, and that's incredibly long, so this little delta E is trivial. But the problem is that once you allow black holes to form and disappear and annihilate information, well, you know that anything in physics that is not forbidden is compulsory, specifically in quantum physics. And so these kinds of processes should enter into loop diagrams. And here I've drawn kind of a cartoon of what I have in mind. So say you scatter two particles at low energies. Well, there's a loop diagram where another particle comes back around and is high energy, so you form a black hole, and then that black hole evaporates, and here's the outgoing Hawking radiation. Again, that's a cartoon, but the basic idea is there should be virtual black holes in loop diagrams all over the place. And if you lose information in black hole evaporation, you should lose information in these processes, these virtual processes as well. There's nothing to forbid it. And this information will be lost all the time from these loop processes. And the cutoff sort of times for this kind of process is going to be of order of the Planck time. So the amount of energy you're going to typically lose is of order of the Planck energy. And that's a disaster. Indeed, Banks, Peskin, and Suskin, not too long after Hawking's original arguments, argued that with this going on, you would see in this room that we would be at a thermal bath, or in a thermal bath, at the Planck temperature. Okay, that's obviously a huge disaster. Energy conservation is grossly violated. That obviously has nothing to do with what we see.
Back away from it.
Well, okay, you could, well, right, to really clean it up, you'd think about having some cutoff, but even, you know, you're even in trouble if you, say, have 10 Planck size or something. Okay. So, you don't know what sort of replaces this when this gets to be, or when the time really gets to be of order of Planck time, but once the information loss is allowed, the only bound on when it sort of stops is the Planck size. Okay. That, so we don't know the details of what happens at that point, but that's the only bound. So okay, so this looks horrible, and so we better think of something else. Well, so let's think more carefully about whether information can come back out of a black hole. So here's a picture of, again, black hole formation and evaporation. You might say, well, you know, is there some way that the information on the internal slice could be conveyed to the external Hawking radiation? So here's a Hawking photon coming out. And really, this just boils down to locality, and I'll say more about that. But basically, the degrees of freedom here are space-like separated from the degrees of freedom there. So locality tells you that they're independent, and there's no way to transfer information from degrees of freedom here to degrees of freedom there. And so as long as this process is semi-classical, as long as the black hole is large as compared to the Planck size, really locality tells you that the information can't be sneaking out. Of course, what happens at the Planck size is another story, but at least the information can't come out before that time by locality. Okay, well, so what's the alternative? The only alternative that we can imagine at this point, assuming locality and energy conservation, is that somehow the information is left when the black hole evaporates and doesn't disappear. So what this means is that when the black hole evaporates, you are left with some remnant that contains the information in its internal quantum states, and that persists. Now, what are some properties of remnants? Well, first of all, since they would emerge once the black hole had reached the Planck size, you'd expect them to be perhaps roughly Planckian in energy or mass. Secondly, they have to be long-lived because they contain a huge amount of information and they don't have much accessible energy, so it would take a long time for them to completely decay, and you can make estimates, but it's a long, long time as compared to their mass. And finally, if this is the correct picture, these remnants must have infinite internal states, because you could have formed an arbitrarily large black hole, say if you're working in an asymptotically Minkowskian context, arbitrarily large black hole could have been made, and you have to have remnants to contain, that can contain the amount of information in such an arbitrarily large black hole. So that's unbounded, and you must have an infinite number of internal states of remnants if This is the picture. Okay, well, so far so good. So that must be the answer because we've eliminated all other possibilities. Blue, well, yeah, well, I'm just thinking about it from the point of view of an asymptotic observer at this point. But I am actually, what I'm going to say does, there is a connection with what Tuft was saying, but I'm not sure if it comes up. Yeah, unless, well, okay. Let's, okay, yeah. Let me.
The lifetime is greater than the lifetime?
Of the remnants? Yes, it must be much greater, actually. It's a power of m, I forget, I think it's m to the fourth or something. And again, the reason why is because, say you start out with a black hole with mass m, then that would evaporate to a remnant with an amount of information given by the entropy, so m squared, right? So you've got this thing with m squared information content, and for that to decay, well, it's only got an energy, m Planck. Okay, so for it to decay, it has to spit out, you know, rough, say enough photons to convey all that m squared information. And so since it's only got accessible energy of m Planck, that huge number of photons must correspond to, well, very low energy photons, like 1 over m squared per photon. And to emit those low energy photons takes a very long time because, you know, low energy photons are long time objects. So that's the basic idea.
So this time is like the age of the universe?
Well, it depends on him. I forget. I think it's m to the fourth is the total lifetime or something like that. It's big. It's much, far bigger than the mass of the remnant. That's all you really need to discover that you're in trouble, as I'm about to argue. Okay, so why are we in trouble? Well, let's consider car-car scattering. Okay, so if you scatter two cars at sufficiently high energy, above the... So there's a center of mass energy above the Planck scale. Do you make remnants? Well, of course, you know, the form factors for cars are very complicated. But of course, there's some very, very tiny probability that in this process, with enough accessible energy, you would make one of these remnants. Big deal. It's incredibly tiny. But then when you compute the total rate to produce remnants, you've got to multiply by the number of species in the final state. And that number of species, I just told you, was infinite. And so it doesn't matter how small this is. The answer is infinity. So every ordinary physical process you can think of will lead to infinite remnant production. And that's obviously crazy. And so we're stuck. Again, it's an in-principle question. If we work in a Minkowski background, just think about this as a problem in, you know, unless somehow there's something inconsistent with Minkowski space, but that doesn't seem like it should be the answer. You can make an arbitrarily large black hole. So you can have a remnant with an arbitrarily large amount of information contained in it, in principle, and therefore the number of internal states must be infinity. The amount of information that a remnant can contain must be unbounded. Okay, so to summarize, we're in a fix. Information loss implies energy non-conservation of a very disastrous fashion. Information return corresponds to locality violation. Well, that would mean we can send signals faster than the speed of light, and therefore back in time, and therefore you could arrange to have your grandmother killed before your mother is born and get into various paradoxes like that, one believes. And finally, the third possibility of remnants leads to gross instabilities in various physical all physical processes, basically. And that is the nature of the paradox. Okay. Any other questions so far? Okay, so we're in a fix, but let's think about this further. So in particular, let's examine Hawking's arguments a little bit more carefully. So how do we know that we can decompose the Hilbert space on that intermediate slice into an inside and outside Hilbert space? How do we know that we can use locality in that context? Well, first let's discuss this in standard quantum field theory. So here's a space-like slice. And the statement of locality in standard quantum field theory is that observables at different points on this slice will always commute. Observables at any space-like separations commute. Now, of course, if we want to study black hole information, we really have to include, we have to go one step beyond this. We have to include effects of gravity. So to think about statements of locality, you have to come up with some analogous statement here, including gravity. So let's imagine that we have some approximately local observables that are the gravitationally dressed analogs of these things. Now you might say, well, how do we know such things exist in gravity? Well, we're working on trying to better understand how to mathematically describe them, but clearly there must be some mathematical description of what you or I are doing right now, which is observing stuff, okay? And so what we have in mind is that there should be some operators, they don't necessarily have to be fully local, but that play the role of, well, localized observables in physics. And so these are the closest things we can get to local observables in gravity, is what we have in mind here. And they should reduce to quantum field theory observables in the semi-classical limit. Okay, now we should have, and really you have to assume something like this, let me say, to run Hawking's argument. Hawking's argument should include the effects of gravity, and you really have to assume something like this is going on if you want to be decomposing the Hilbert space. So implicitly, that is an assumption, I believe, of Hawking's arguments. Okay, so we're working to better characterize what these things are. Eventually, we'll actually say something about that. Okay, now the next question is, if you have such approximately local operators, when do they fail to commute? When does locality break down? Well, let's first think about just a scalar field coupled to gravity. Could be one of the string states coupled to gravity, for that matter. Though what I'm going to say isn't directly dependent on string theory. Now, first of all, this operator in field theory is truly localized at a point. And so in a sense, it's really a very singular object. It creates states all the way up to infinite momentum. So it's better to think about operators with an approximately definite position and momentum. These are operators, say, in free scalar field theory that create and annihilate particles in minimum uncertainty wave packets with some, you know, Gaussian wave packet about a definite x and a definite p. And if you want to instead think about these, then the statement of locality just in ordinary quantum field theory is not that these operators commute, but that they commute up to the exponential tails of the wave packets. Okay, now if we think about the gravitationally dressed versions of those, incorporating the effects of gravity, and think about when these operators should commute that correspond to creating particles with definite, approximately definite position and momenta. Well, I think that it's really impossible to say that these operators will commute once the separation between the two particles that you're trying to create is less than the center of mass energy of the two particles. In this situation, you have a strong gravitational back reaction when trying to think about these two operators in the field theory. Because what you're trying to do is create two particles in a region where, in this situation, gravitational effects are so strong that, well, if these were just classical particles, you'd be forming a black hole. Incredibly gravitationally strong effects are taking place here. So you have no right to believe that a local or a standard field theory analysis applies in that situation. And basically, that's the statement of what we call the locality bound, that this is where locality should fail in gravitational physics. Now, you might say, okay, we've got a bound relating separations to center of mass energies, and there's obviously a dimensionful constant that has to come into here. What is it? Is it the string length or the Planck length? Or these stringy effects or gravitational effects? My belief, which I hope to have time to say a few words about at the towards the end of the talk, is that really the relevant coefficient here is the Planck length. The relevant physics is the is strong gravity, not long strings. And so what I'm going to say shouldn't rely, I don't think, much on string theory at all for the rest of this talk. Okay, so the upshot of this is that if you look at the Hilbert space on that intermediate slice, the fact that it decomposes into a product is only an approximate statement, and it's only known to be true for certain states, and for those states that are well described semi-classically, and in particular don't violate the locality bound. Now let's think about what states are relevant for the black hole information paradox. Any questions so far? Yeah, Matt.
Is there some sense in which this argument is really using gravity, or could you make the same argument, say, in an effective field theory for, I don't know, let's say, suppose you try to make this argument for pi?
I don't think so. I think, you know, really the problem is that gravity describes fluctuations of space-time. So you can't, you know, whenever you have field theory, you know that you can write down operators that commute as long as they're space-like separated. You know, as long as you don't talk about gravity, operators commute, space-like separated. Of course, you know, if you're in some non-renormalizable theory, at some point the whole system goes haywire when you reach the non-renormalizability scale, or the scale that governs the higher dimensional operators. Then you just can't say anything. So maybe what you would say in that circumstance is if you bring the operators, you know, to that scale, can't compute anymore.
I guess I'm just wondering if you're actually using, in this argument that you just gave in the previous transparency, are you really using anything more than just saying, well, if you have a non-renormalizable theory, at some point, you know, just trying to treat a Hilbert space for theory is going to not allow an argument for this time, where you just sharply separate.
There may well be an analogous statement there. I hadn't thought about that. You know, really in gravity, I think the problem is even worse in a sense, because we know that, again, the very nature of causality and locality and so on, it breaks down. So you have strong space-time deformation there. So
it should get worse. It just might not get worse at this stage.
Yeah. It could be that you have the same problem one way, gravity, or in the case that you're talking about, a non-renormalizable theory. But I think that illustrates the problem, actually. That's a nice example. That illustrates the problem when you have a non-renormalizable theory. You have a similar set of issues. Okay, so is this relevant, or could this be relevant? Well, let's look a little bit more carefully at how we would really say whether information comes out of a black hole. So the idea is, you know, what would you actually try to measure? If you have a black hole that you form... Uh-oh. Okay, what'd I do? I think we fell into a black hole.
Okay. The information, however, seems to be true.
Yes. Okay, so what would you, if you form a black hole and let it Hawking evaporate, you know, say if you could even make them in colliders, what would you look at to try to see if the information came out or not? Well, you look at the density matrix on this final slice after the black hole has evaporated. So how do you tell if a density matrix has missing information or not? Well, let's just look at a 2x2 example where you have, say, a density matrix in a two-state system consisting of spin up and spin down, so the generic density matrix is of that form. How do you know if that's pure or not? Well, one way of saying whether or not it's pure is whether this combination of expectation values of the usual spin operators adds up to exactly one or not. And so that combination, in order to answer that question, does this add up to exactly one? Well, you need this precise combination, and you need definite phase information, and so on. You need to really have a precise handle on each of these expectation values. Alternatively, there's this general formula. This is just another way of saying something very closely related. There's this general formula. You have to know all of the elements of the density matrix, and you have to compute trace of rho log rho in order to answer whether the information is missing or not, whether the state is pure or not. Okay, so the analogous statement here should be something like the following, that you look at, say, the expectation value for all possible configurations of final state particles, N1 particles in the X1, P1 state, and so on the final slice. And really, you have to know all of those expectation values and add up the appropriate combinations of those with the appropriate phases to determine whether or not information is present. Now, Hawking's argument avoids, of course, direct determination of these because it's hard, but Hawking takes a shortcut and argues that these things correspond to a mixed state because of this commutativity argument that operators inside and outside the black hole commute, and therefore you do have this product of internal and external Hilbert space, and you take the trace, so you must get something up here that corresponds to a density matrix with missing information. Okay. But we should be suspect of such statements. We need to know that these commutators vanish in order to make Hawking's argument. And that needs to be true on, the initial slice, the final slice just before the black hole disappears, and every slice in between. The statements are all related. That needs to be true for all of the X's and P's describing the matrix elements or the degrees of freedom relevant for the process. So we really need this product Hilbert space structure to hold throughout that entire region to believe this. And now you can say, well, is that in accord with what we've said about when locality should fail? Or at least certainly cannot be trusted any longer. Well, the locality bound, as I stated it, I basically stated it in flat space, in a flat background, and it's actually a little hard to come up with a precise statement in curved space. It's much easier in flat space. But fortunately, the relevant questions for a black hole can be at least examined pretty closely in something that looks approximately flat. Specifically, if you zoom in on a black hole, and here I'm going to draw a Kruskal diagram of a black hole, singularity, horizon, and I've extended it just for simplicity to, the full extended, Kruskal geometry. If you zoom in on a black hole and look at distances to the horizon that are small as compared to the horizon size, so inside these dotted red lines, then the black hole geometry is approximately flat, and it's approximately flat in the usual Rindler picture. So I'll call this the Rindler region. So we're going to try to address these questions just by looking at dynamics in the Rindler region. Okay, so what happens if you look at the relevant states and just try to talk about them in the Rindler region? So here's a, say, trajectory of an infalling particle, the part of it that's in the Rindler region. Let's suppose we're talking about measuring that particle somewhere down inside the black hole. And here's a trajectory of a Hawking state, a Hawking particle, We're going to just trace that to the Rindler region and imagine we're trying to measure that outside the horizon and see whether it contains independent information from the particle inside.
So,
yep.
Before you were saying you were focusing on the asymptotic observer.
Yes, now, right.
So this is not an operational observation that you can make.
Right? No, no, you should. Okay, well, initially I said, before I started talking about, initially I said we'll focus on asymptotics. But to really run Hawking's argument, you have to talk about local things. That's part of the point.
So I understand that if you want to avoid the conclusion of the theory, presume unitarity, you see that there's a problem as soon as we did, then you assume that the causal structure is trivial ultimately, that everything comes back. So in that sense, I understand that then you should be able to discuss the whole slice, but I would still think that it would be hard to make an operational definition of this observation you're talking about before you solve the problem, before you really understand what happens to the singularity.
No, okay, I don't think so, but let me try to say a few more words about that. So first of all, let me just emphasize, in order to make Stephen's argument for information loss, you have to assume this decomposition of the Hilbert space, and therefore you have to assume that you know things about local physics. That's just an ingredient in what Hawking is saying in his original argument. So now we're going to say, well, how could you imagine really understanding that in a theory with gravity and quantum mechanics? Well, you've got to have some notion of local or localizable or approximately local observables. And we don't have a fully complete mathematical description of such observables yet. I certainly believe that such things exist because, I think that that's what describes the reality that you or I see. You're over there observing things, I'm over here observing slightly different things. So there ought to be a mathematical description of that. Now the question is, if there are such operators, when do they cease to be local? And I've attempted to give a general description of that, at least one situation where we strongly believe that we can no longer trust locality. So in this picture, this is, say, an observation made by an observer outside the black hole. Maybe you, if there's a horizon coming right through here. And this is an observation made by someone inside the black hole, unfortunately me, because I'm on the other side. And so this is, a realistic kind of situation to describe. Does that make sense?
So you are then considering the meta-observable where you simultaneously discuss
what... I'm going to... Yeah. Let me stand back. What I want to do is I want to see how close you can come to making Hawking's argument if you really think about it. And then we're going to find out that there's a problem. Okay. So I want to try to see, imagine how you would do make Hawking's argument and conclude that information is lost. And then we're going to discover that there's a problem when you try to make his argument. When you really think about it, and that problem is important. You just leave it at that. Okay, so I'm trying to make the kind of argument he would make. At this point, Hawking, I think, would be with us. And the question is, what goes wrong? Okay, so here I've coordinatized this in terms of radial coordinates in Rindler space. And so we just have some particle here, which, for example, could be at so-called theta equals zero and some radial coordinate in Rindler space. And then the other outgoing particle is some other radial coordinate, and the angular coordinate in Rindler space corresponds to basically how far up in time this thing is. I could describe the details of the coordinatization, but I don't want to dive too deep into that. It'd take a little bit of explaining. Now, in standard quantum field theory, in this situation, we would say that operators here and here commute, or if we're looking at these wave packet operators, by zero I really mean exponentially small. And operators here and here commute, if you follow these slices back in the center of momentum frame, for example, and so on. And in fact, those statements are related. Field theory evolution tells you that this commutes if and only if this commutes, and so on. So all along this region, things commute all the way back. That's what field theory would tell you, but let's think about what really ought to be true here. So we're going to, again, work in the center of momentum frame and think about what the locality bound would tell you. And in fact, if you follow this evolution, you don't have to follow it far before you discover you actually violate the locality bound. You violate it at a time in the center of momentum frame where the center of momentum momentum or energy is, of course, larger than the separation. That was the statement of the locality bound. And if you think about when you violate it, if this particle up here was a Hawking particle, so it has an energy, according to the asymptotic Schwarzschild observer of order 1 over m, the temperature of the black hole, and if it's coming out at a time tau, well, it's violated at a center of momentum time given by this formula, and a distance separation between the two given by this formula. And notice that there's this huge exponential in the formula in the time. And this typical time for a Hawking photon coming out that might carry some of the information that had gone in, you expect to be of order m cubed. And there's some general arguments by Page about why that's when you expect information to start coming out at timescales comparable to the black hole's lifetime. But let's just look at that time scale. So for that time scale, this separation at which the locality bound is violated is of order e to the m squared for a black hole of mass m. And that is saying that this bound is violated at distances much larger than the black hole size. So you get into deep trouble relatively quickly when you try to conclude, when you try to think about whether these degrees of freedom are independent of those degrees of freedom. You get in trouble quite quickly. And you can't conclude that the operators commute. Actually, let me keep that diagram in mind. You can't conclude that they commute here at a slightly earlier time. And of course, in ordinary field theory, the statement that they commute is preserved over time. In fact, as I said, if and only if they commute here, do they commute here. And so the whole argument that Hawking might have attempted to make collapses. You can't say that the state inside the black hole is independent. The state inside the black hole is independent of the state outside.
Are you confused with the fact that the Hawking particles localized or something?
I'm saying that's variable. I want to think about a basis of states, and I can choose whatever basis I like, basically. And it's true that, when you trace them back, you could certainly work in a basis where you have narrow wave packets back at
the... That's sort of misleading. I mean, the Hawking particles really are very large things.
What I have in mind, and this is, you can work out the details, but, the typical momentum I'm using here, say, is the momentum of a Hawking particle translated into these coordinates. So energy 1 over m, basically. So I think this is a realistic description of those, and we could try to nail that down more, but maybe not in real time.
Is the statement that your wind or wedge, in order to stay on the right-hand side of the horizon, you have to accelerate a particle?
You have to accelerate a particle.
Well, in order for something to stay
yes.
on that side of the horizon, you have
yes.
to...
Yeah.
Pushing.
Yes. Well, right. Yeah. It's the usual statement you're used to, that if you take an asymptotic wave corresponding to a Hawking particle, and you trace it back to the vicinity of the horizon, it's very high momentum. It's connected to that statement. There are different frames to look at that statement.
I always thought that was sort of bring this looming picture, because then you sort of learn that, you know, all photons in the universe now or something, you trace it back, or the Big Bang, or ultra plane, you know, that trust any.
There is a very interesting question about how this would apply in the context of the Big Bang.
It's always a little bit dangerous how to be tracing backwards in time.
You might say it's dangerous, but I think it's necessary to make Hawking's argument, basically. Because really that's how Hawking's argument is made. You have to look at precisely the state on, you know, say that early slice, and precisely say that you have a decomposition and that you had a pure state and that decomposes into, you know, some entangled state, and then you trace and you get a mixed state. So you have to do that. Whether or not it's in, yes, it's dangerous, and yes, we're talking about
it. I
guess
the question is, I mean, it seems clear there's some sort of breakdown of decomposition between the states inside and out.
So yes.
The question is, operators are sort of giving rise to the radiation. Are these really things that are well localized at the horizon? It's sort of this stuff creating the opening particles is very delocalized. And
well,
they might be sort of far enough away from the sun inside that there wouldn't be any clash with your locality bound. So.
Well, we could talk more about why you think they're delocalized. What I'm trying to do is nail down exactly why, you know, what effects are responsible for there being issues with locality in comparing things inside and outside. So that's what this is an attempt to do, to characterize that. And I don't, you know, maybe there's some other argument that for some other reason you get in trouble with locality, but I haven't seen that yet, and we could try to. You know, if you want to try to explain that to me, I'd be interested. So, okay, so in fact, you can ask, okay, for what Schwarzschild emission time, so if you have a black hole that forms and evaporates, and you're just out here measuring when the Hawking radiation comes out, at what time would such a photon have to come out that would violate the locality bound with a generic infalling particle that made the black hole in the first place? And in fact, once you reach center of mass energies large as compared to the size of the black hole, generically you will violate the locality bound, you know, on an earlier slice. And that corresponds to a time, m log m squared, a Schwarzschild time for the emission of the photon. So this is some characteristic of how quickly the information gets transmitted to the outgoing modes. And in fact, that agrees with a time that Susskind has discussed, the holographic spreading time. Let me just make that comment in connection and press on, because time is getting short. In fact, this is a single mode analysis. I've just talked about one outgoing Hawking particle and one infalling particle, but really, I said that you should think about these correlators where you have the whole ensemble of outgoing Hawking particles. You're studying properties of the whole state, and you really have to measure those things to compute the information content. That corresponds to having of order m squared insertions, and it may well be that for these multi-point functions, it looks quite likely that the locality bound would be directly saturated even for later times for the Hawking radiation coming out. And so, in fact, that you might not even have to go through this argument where you trace back from in the Rindler region from a slice at a given time to an earlier time to see the violation of the locality bound. You might just see it directly in these in the m squared point functions that you really should be considering. Okay, so let me briefly mention, of course, related ideas have certainly appeared in the literature before, the TUF, the Verlindes, and so on. Really, what's responsible for this is the large blue shift that people have known about for a long time. But here, we're trying to make a connection to the issue of really checking the purity of the state through measuring the matrix elements and what you would have to do to check that. You really need this decomposition of the Hilbert space. Moreover, we're looking at, you do have to think about the high energy physics of, in effect, gravitational scattering in comparing these particles inside and outside the black hole. And the claim is that the relevant physics is black hole formation. And Tuff said somewhat reminiscent things, but he was modeling the gravitational physics in terms of these shifts and so on. And again, I can't really elaborate on that, but I think people who've seen these arguments before know what I mean. Also, Lowe et al. Had made similar statements based on the large blue shifts, but they got stuck. The authors of the paper couldn't agree. Oops, getting tangled up. That they had found a gauge invariant signal for the requisite locality violation. There still appears to be dissent among them. And what they were saying is that there are non-local effects because basically you're creating long strings between two observations. And that those contribute to relevant correlators instead of the relevant physics being strong gravitational effects. So I'd like to take, I think I have, what, maybe 10 more minutes according to, I'd like to take the last 10 minutes to address the question of the relation of these effects to stringy effects, gravitational effects to stringy effects. In fact, you might say, where would a locality bound originate? So let's work in d dimensions. And in fact, if you think about, if you have some energy here at point x and some energy here at point y, and think about when would you have enough energy that you could make a long string connecting the two, and in some sense, therefore, have non-local physics perhaps be relevant from the stretched string, well, this is a characterization of the situation in which you could be creating long strings, and the relevant scale that comes in is the string scale. Now, in higher than four dimensions, you even have a different parametric dependence on the separation because you know that the answer to the question of, you know, if I have energy here and energy here, when do I make strong gravitational physics? When do I have a black hole? The separation comes to a different power in answering that question. Moreover, the coefficient in here is the Planck scale as opposed to the string scale. So which effect is responsible for breakdown of locality? And I think that there's evidence, somewhat circumstantial, that at long distances it's gravity, not string creation. And this is actually related to the question of, you know, once we reach the Planck scale threshold in high energy scattering, say at particle accelerators someday, do we make black holes first or do we make strings first? Now, before I tell you what the circumstantial evidence is, let me just say that if the answer is what I'm advocating, that gravitational physics is the relevant physics for the locality bound, and for saying what was wrong with Hawking's arguments, then the genericity of these arguments for why information inside and outside the black hole is not independent is really a very satisfying mirror of the genericity of Hawking's original arguments for information loss. He never said anything about string theory. It was sort of, in a sense, an effective field theory-like argument for a generic field theory coupled to gravity. And so that argument was independent of the microscopic dynamics of gravity. And if our picture is correct, I think that the argument for where that goes wrong looks to me likewise independent of microscopic dynamics of gravity. Okay, so why do I say that? Let's think of strong gravitational scattering. So let's suppose we scatter two particles with impact parameter B, center of mass energy E, and let's ask as we lower the impact parameter, what is the dominant effect? If we're making large strings, you would expect, if that's an important effect, you would expect that effect to come in when the separation is of order E. That's where you have enough energy to create a string that stretches across the region span, stretches across the region that the two particles are being focused into, given by the impact parameter. But if it's strong gravity, actually the effects that are important take place at a shorter distance, given by basically the Schwarzschild radius. So what's more important? Where do you actually start seeing non-trivial effects in scattering? Am I okay? Keep getting snagged on the table. No. In general, I'm assuming that the Planck scale and the string scale are... Oh, wait. Did I write it that way? Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I said B. There's a coefficient in here. In one case, it's the Planck scale, and the other case, it's the string scale as well. But the parametric dependence on energy is even more important, in a sense, because that's a bigger difference, so to speak, for large energies.
Is ultra-high energies.
Yeah, say for energies larger as compared to the Planck scale. So anyway, we could put the constants in, but it's not. I mean, that's part of the story, but it's not critical. Well, you might think so, but the question is, are strings important at some large impact parameter? Say at some impact parameter of that size for ultra-large energy scattering. Well, okay, so let's try to answer that question. So another way of saying it is, let's graph the regions where things are relevant. So if you look at energy as a function of impact parameter, I've just drawn those two curves I was talking about. For energies larger than b to the d minus 3, and again, there's some coefficient in here, you would expect strong gravitational effects to be important, to be the relevant physics if that's important. And if long string physics is important, you would expect that to take place at energies larger as compared to b. So far, so good. Well, is there any way of getting a handle on this? And seeing, you know, where you get, say, modifications to or contributions to scattering for large impact parameters that would tell you something about what is the physics going on in these regions. Well, actually, this relates back to work done by Amati, Ciafolini, and Veneziano some time ago. And they studied string scattering at fixed T and large S. And if you translate what that means their analysis should be valid for E less than B to the D minus 3 over 2. And so, in fact, they are able to say what goes on outside this red line. Their analysis should hold there. And what they found is that the scattering agrees with that described by long-distance gravity, with corrections of order R Schwarzschild over B. And that's what you would expect. You don't see their analysis is valid to the right of this line. You don't see any evidence of strong effects due to long strings all the way down to here, and then you don't know what happens. But at least you're ruling out that long strings, if you believe their analysis, you're ruling out that long strings are relevant.
Steve,
yes?
Is that inclusive or exclusive scattering?
I think you asked me this before. And I think I gave you the wrong answer before, so let me see if I can remember the answer. They were, actually, I think it was exclusive. We should talk about this later.
I'm confused about this.
Yeah.
This is two string scatters to make a single long string?
Well, okay, what they're doing, let's say look at an in or exclusive scattering. So you have two states scattering to two, and you ask yourself, when do you get something that differs from, say, just the semi-classical, you know, single graviton exchange? When do you get something that corrects that? And so they have examined that in string theory, and they argue that there's nothing that corrects that in the region to the right of the red line. There are no strong effects, no important effects beyond, you know, leading graviton, single graviton exchange, and, you know, subleading corrections that basically correspond to multigraviton exchange. And in particular, in string theory, you're not seeing somehow that you get a big effect because as you collide these things, you're making a long string. There's no evidence for such a contribution. Well, okay, yeah. So what's going on? What's going on? This is a good question. So why aren't long strings relevant? Well, there's another piece of circumstantial evidence. Let's think about what you're doing here. So if you go to Gross and Mendes' analysis, which they also looked at a related regime, and I'm getting close to the end, I'm almost there. they looked at large S and fixed angle and asked, what kinds of configurations do you make when you, you know, scatter things at high energies? And they found that the dominant configurations are not those where you have, say, a single string separating the two points, so to, or the two particles, the two incoming strings is what they really are. But what you do is you have the world sheet sort of wraps up. The dominant configuration has G strings with total size, therefore, E over G. So you have enough energy to make a string of length E, but you're wrapping it up G times. And so that's what they were saying. And then that was at a given order in perturbation theory. And when you look at what is the dominant order in perturbation theory, well, Mendy and Oguri argued that the sum was dominated for large G of order E. So if you take that as a signal where the most important dynamics is taking place, that's saying that the effects are spread over a region of size of order the just the string scale, G over G, or E over E, or whatever, one. Okay, so the size where stringy effects are important is the string scale. It's not some macroscopic scale that grows with the energy. So that's a clue. That's a clue. Of course, this analysis, applying this analysis this far is a little shaky, so this is just supposed to be a hint. And it fails. Well, various things go wrong, but it fails, for example, at energies largest compared to this scale and so on. But the bottom line is, when last seen in this regime, what you were doing is you scattered particles or strings at higher and higher energies. You aren't producing long strings, but you're producing strings that are wound up so that the total thing produced has a size of order the string scale. That logarithmically what grows?
The string.
Well, I think that's probably before you take into account interactions.
Certainly.
And so what you do, this again, this is you know, at a given order in perturbation theory, this is what's going on, and then you ask what's the dominant order, and it's not the sort of tree level where you just say have a single string stretch, but the dominant order is where you have this thing that's all wound up. So I'm taking that as a serious hint. I realize this is not an ironclad argument, but it's a hint that matches, or at least gives some more support to the analysis of Amati, Ciafaloni, and Veneziano, that they weren't finding any evidence of long string contributions at large distances where you might have expected to find them. So this seems to sort of fit together. Okay, so let me just make a quick general comment and then conclude. And that is, we've grappled a lot with the ideas of holography, and in particular have sought to understand how to think about localized space-time processes holographically. And it seems to me that if this kind of way of looking at things is correct, and in particular the ideas of the locality bound or some appropriate generalization, then this is sort of providing a deeper underpinning for the implementation of holographic ideas, which is somewhat perhaps analogous to the role of the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics. It's a limitation, fundamental limitation, that tells you sort of where locality breaks down, analogous to the uncertainty principle telling you where classical physics breaks down. So just to conclude, the slogan for what supposed to go wrong with Hawking's argument is that, well, semi-classical quantum field theory techniques like he uses are good for computing things like the expectation value of the stress tensor for energy coming out of a black hole and so on, simple things. But that semi-classical techniques break down when you compute these things, multi-point functions, which you really need to compute all of those to really say whether or not the information is present and determine the purity of the density matrix. So you really need to know about all of the matrix elements of the density matrix, and the argument is that when you try to really ask that question, can I compute those, you get into trouble. So the origin of this breakdown is supposed to be this strong gravitational back reaction, and that was our proposal for how the information paradox should be resolved in favor of unitary evolution at the sacrifice of locality. So, thank you.
Questions for Steve?
So the conclusion is that there is no information loss?
That would be, yeah, that would be the suggestion, that this is giving the idea, which obviously should be better quantified, the idea for why the states inside and outside the black hole are not truly independent, and therefore the argument for information loss is not correct.
And so the idea is that you have correlations on space-like separated distances.
Well, yeah, the idea is that the idea is that there's a true sense in which the degrees of freedom inside the black hole and outside the black hole are not independent degrees of freedom. And that's, you know, that's an idea that's not original to us. That's black hole complementarity or thing, you know, related ideas. But this is really trying to explain why that would happen. So. Yeah, Clifford.
Some of the ideas that are coming up recently, I think somewhere in the America book, it was in there as well, but perhaps more clearly, Maturus has been saying these sorts of things for years, which is that in some sense the black hole never really forms.
I don't think that's the correct statement. I think that a semi-classical observer, or say, I think you or I could fall into a
question yet.
Okay.
So I was wondering whether the techniques you're using here could shed some light on that. Is there a way of seeing the breakdown in the processes that are going on and studying the formation of the black hole itself and seeing the breakdown along the lines that you've advocated here? Do you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, well, okay.
To test out whether you could say just with these arguments that the black hole can't form.
Now, I my picture somehow, and, you know, it's obviously going to be quite a bit of work to really spell it all out in detail. Well, let me first make the comment. The things that Mathur is arguing, has made his arguments about, aren't even really black holes to begin with, because of the horizon size issue and so on. They're not analogous to Schwarzschild black holes with macroscopic horizons. He is making the argument that black holes, in some sense, don't form. I would say that this picture fits well with the basic ideas of black hole complementarity, and obviously, you know, Lenny Susskind has played a very important role in enunciating these, and obviously at Tuft, that somehow you can fall into a black hole, and you can know you've fallen into a black hole, and, you know, you start getting scrunched and so on. You could feel that. Nothing goes wrong at the horizon. And someone can stay outside, and they can measure things. And somehow, though those are not described by independent degrees of freedom. So black holes do really form, and, you know, I could test that if I were willing to go exploring into the black hole in the center of the galaxy or other black holes. I could test that. I may not be able to send you my results, but, you know, in that sense, black holes really form. So I wouldn't argue that they don't take place. I think, again, there ought to be some notion of complementarity. I think this picture is trying to explain where complementarity could come from.
Yeah, but just to say a little more, I don't think they're denying that for all intents and purposes, the classical and semi-classical picture of a black hole exists. There is a regime in which it makes sense to write down a metric and say, this is for all intents and purposes going to describe some of the physics. Mm-hmm. I think what he's saying is when we get to the details of trying to understand things like the information paradox and what have you, really get down to the nitty-gritty and full quantum gravity,
mm-hmm.
The thing we think of as a black hole is just an illusion. It's just an approximation to an underlying picture, which is just there's a lot of these states which you can write down sensible evolution for.
Well, there are various things that doesn't tell me. I mean, it could somehow fit with that picture, but the problem is that, you know, a black hole really shouldn't be an illusion.
Why?
for some people, right? Those unfortunate enough to fall in. There should really be a description of that. I firmly believe that. There should be a description of that. So not in terms of asymptotic. Well, not, no, I mean, I fall in and it starts getting painful because I'm getting squeezed. That does not require great precision to state, right? It's turning into spaghetti. So, well, no, so the question is, you know, is when you ultimately describe the physics, do you just not have any description that corresponds to that, or do you have a description that corresponds to that, and somehow that gets reconciled with the observations of an outside observer? This is a suggestion for how that could take place. Conceivably, black holes, well, not in my mind, but conceivably perhaps in other people's minds, black holes just don't form. And people, but then it's pretty weird too, because you've got to, well, in some sense that seems an even more radical solution, because then you've got to explain how, you know, how at an even more profound level weakly coupled gravitational physics blows up in your face. And I don't think Matur's analysis, and others, you know, I think you've worked on this as well, and others, I think, really addresses that question, because it's not looking at black hole physics in a regime where you expect to have horizons analogous to Schwarzschild horizons, ordinarily, that, and that you're somehow providing some other description of those. So, so there are some hints there, but the but really those things, it could be the right answer there, that you have some solitonic description of something there, but that's not the correct description for a big black hole with mass large as compared to its charge, say.
So. Thanks, Steve.